I want you to take a second and just look around you right now.
Yeah, just take it all in.
Exactly. I mean, maybe you're sitting at a desk, or maybe you're in your car, or, maybe you're just looking at your own hand.
Right.
You woke up today feeling absolutely certain that you live in a world made of solid stuff, like tables, cars, human bodies.
Physical nouns, basically.
Yes, exactly. Our entire lives are built on this massive assumption that reality is constructed out of these physical nouns. But our sources today suggest that every single person listening to this deep dive is actually living under a massive, completely functional, incredibly vivid illusion.
It is a pretty wild premise. And we are looking at a stack of materials today that spans, well, everything from cutting-edge quantum physics to the personal diaries of the founders of quantum mechanics, all the way to deep Buddhist philosophy.
It's quite the mix.
It really is. And independently, across thousands of years and radically different disciplines, they all arrive at the exact same conclusion, which is that reality is not made of fundamental building blocks. So we're going to deconstruct something these sources call the classical spell. And we'll explore this radical new framework for reality known as the grammar of non-substantialism.
Which I know sounds like a very heavy title, but to put it into perspective, the whole mission of this deep dive today is to explore a universe that is entirely composed of verbs rather than nouns.
Yeah, it's a total paradigm shift.
It really is. And we're going to pull from a wildly diverse set of materials. I mean, we've got insights from a YouTube video by The Sleeping Physicist.
Great channel, by the way.
Oh, fantastic channel. We are also looking at the personal coat of arms of Nobel laureate Niels Bohr. And we're diving into the concept of karma. And not as some cosmic point system, but as a literal mechanism of physics,
Right.
all to answer one mind-bending question, really. If the universe isn't made of nouns and things, what exactly is it?
Well, the first hurdle here is just recognizing the trap our brains fall into every single second of the day. And that is the illusion of the fundamental building block.
Okay, I'm going to push back on this immediately because, I mean, my brain is actively resisting the premise.
I don't blame you.
Like, if I reach out right now and I knock on this wooden desk,
It's solid.
yeah, it hurts my knuckles, it makes a sharp sound, it pushes back against my physical hand. My direct, undeniable experience is screaming that there is an underlying substance here.
Right.
So how can any physicist or philosopher seriously argue that this solid stuff isn't actually there?
So that physical reaction, that pain in your knuckles, that is actually the ultimate reinforcement of the classical spell. This is a deeply conditioned human habit, and it traces back at least 2,500 years to the Greek philosopher Democritus.
Oh, the Adam guy.
Exactly. Democritus looked at the world, he saw the movement, the light, the mass, and his mind basically demanded an anchor.
Like it couldn't just be floating without a base.
Exactly. He assumed that all these varying appearances had to rest upon independently existing carriers, so he called them indivisible atoms. And in doing so, he implanted this idea into Western thought that behind every action, there just has to be a hidden, solid actor.
Right. He demanded a noun to perform the verb.
Yes.
Like we experience resistance or weight, and then we just project a hidden substance behind it that supposedly really exists. I know the philosopher Immanuel Kant had a term for this. He called it the noumenon.
Right, the noumenal essence.
Yeah, the noumenal essence, this idea of a hidden, true reality sitting behind our messy perception of things. And science essentially spent the next few centuries desperately trying to find that hidden essence.
And what's fascinating here is that modern physics fell into the exact same cognitive trap.
Wait, really?
Yeah. I mean, when scientists finally cracked open Democritus's atom and realized it wasn't some solid billiard ball at all, they didn't abandon the classical spell.
They just rebranded it.
Exactly. They just invented a new, more mathematically subtle noun.
Which would be quantum fields. Like, scientists smashed the atom, they found a whole bunch of empty space and probabilities, and they simply transferred all that psychological need for an anchor onto quantum fields.
Yep. They started treating the fields as the new ultimate stuff of the universe.
But looking for an ultimate anchor, like a fundamental level that magically gives rise to everything else, that inevitably just leads to an infinite regress, doesn't it?
It completely does. Because if you argue that a physical event is caused by an underlying quantum field, well, the immediate philosophical question is, what anchors the field?
Right. Every localized cause just demands another cause.
Exactly. And the sources we're exploring today argue that reality simply doesn't collapse into a single essence. There's just no hidden base.
You know, the sources reference a brilliant breakdown of this from that video by the sleeping physicist.
Oh, I love this part.
Yeah, it's so good. The video takes on the concept of energy. Because in everyday life, we talk about energy as if it's like a glowing blue liquid inside a battery.
Right. We treat it like a substance you can scoop up and store.
Exactly. Scoop it up, transfer it around. But in quantum physics, energy is absolutely not a substance. The video clarifies that energy is really simply a bookkeeping tool.
It's a relational property. And grasping that distinction, that is what unlocks this entire paradigm.
The analogy they use in the video is altitude.
Right.
If you try to imagine altitude, you realize very quickly that you can't, like, put a jar of altitude on a shelf.
No, you definitely can't.
Because altitude isn't a thing in the world. It's a relationship between an object and the ground. And energy functions the exact same way. It isn't a glowing liquid. It's just a relationship between a physical system and the laws of physics over time.
And this logic totally extends to the foundational physics equations we all learn in school, too.
Oh, right. Like Newton.
Yeah. Take Newton's force equals mass times acceleration F equals ma. I mean, it is a flawless equation that literally landed humanity on the moon.
Sure.
But it works perfectly. Not because it describes some hidden noumenal essences of the universe.
Right.
It works because it is a designation that maps relational regularities. It maps how things interact within a strictly defined frame.
So we're just inventing these conventions. Tables, trees, mass, force.
Exactly. We invent them to navigate this dizzying flow of potential. The math works because designation works, not because we've actually found the ultimate hidden substance.
So we have entirely mistaken the map for the territory.
Precisely.
But here's where it gets really interesting to me. If we know the math works, but the math is telling these scientists that the universe has no solid foundation, how did the actual pioneers of quantum mechanics process this?
It wasn't easy for them, I'll tell you that.
I mean, if I spend my whole life looking for the ultimate building block of reality and my own equations mathematically prove it doesn't exist, that sounds like a recipe for a total psychological breakdown.
And they almost had one. The founding fathers of quantum mechanics actually had to look completely outside of Western logic just to keep their sanity.
That is wild.
They had pushed Western science to its absolute limit, and they found that Aristotelian logic, you know, the bedrock idea that a thing must be either A or not A, it simply broke down at the quantum level.
Right. So to make sense of their own equations, they explicitly sought out Eastern philosophical frameworks.
Yes. And Niels Bohr is a prime example of this.
The architect of quantum mechanics himself.
Exactly. Bohr realized that an electron could behave as a particle or a wave, but not both simultaneously. And Aristotelian logic just cannot handle a universe where the fundamental building block is two contradictory things, depending on how you look at it.
So what did he do?
Well, Bohr actually had to adopt the middle way approach, which is found in Buddhism and Taoism.
The middle way.
Yeah. It avoids two major philosophical extremes.
Yeah.
So on one side, you have eternalism, which is the idea that things have permanent, independent souls or cores.
Okay.
And on the other side, you have nihilism, which is the idea that nothing exists at all.
Ah, so it isn't a solid thing, but it isn't nothing either. It is a relational reality. And Bohr was so dedicated to this philosophical parallel that when he was knighted in Denmark, he actually chose the yin-yang symbol for his personal coat of arms.
I love that detail.
Isn't that amazing? He inscribed it with the motto, "Opposites are complementary." I mean, he was publicly, officially stamping his Nobel Prize-winning physics with Eastern philosophy.
He really was. And his colleague, Werner Heisenberg, the physicist famous for the uncertainty principle, he underwent a remarkably similar ideological shift.
Right, because Heisenberg proved mathematically that you cannot measure both the position and the momentum of a particle with perfect precision.
Exactly. The more you know about where a particle is, the less you know about where it's going.
Which completely shatters the Newtonian idea of a clockwork, perfectly predictable universe.
Absolutely shatters it. And the implications were so deeply counterintuitive that Heisenberg heavily struggled with his own work.
He thought his own math was crazy.
He really did. And that changed in 1929 when he spent time in India as a guest of the celebrated poet and philosopher Rabindranath Tagore. Heisenberg later admitted that his conversations with Tagore were essentially a lifeline.
Because Tagore's philosophy centered on the idea that truth is found in the interconnectedness of things, not in isolated fragments.
Right.
Tagore believed that the relationship precedes the relata, meaning the connection exists before the things being connected.
Which is such a powerful concept.
It is. And Heisenberg saw his physics perfectly mirroring these ancient Indian concepts of interconnectedness and impermanence. I mean, what was considered scientific heresy in Europe was just the foundation of an entire spiritual tradition in the East.
And then you have Erwin Schrödinger, who took this synthesis even further.
Oh, she went all the way.
He really did. He fully adopted Advaita Vedanta philosophy, which is a non-dualist school of Hindu thought. He wrote extensively in his personal diaries that the total number of minds in the universe is exactly one.
Okay, let's unpack why Advaita Vedanta actually solved Schrödinger's math problem. Because in Western math and logic, 1 + 1 = 2.
Right.
But Advaita Vedanta operates on strict non-duality. There are no separate ones to add together.
Exactly.
The separation of objects or the separation of individual consciousnesses is just a localized illusion called Maya.
Yep.
So Schrödinger used this ancient non-dual framework to rationalize the fundamental unity of quantum states. The math of the atom simply did not support the idea of isolated independent actors operating in a void.
So Bohr, Heisenberg, and Schrödinger, they opened the door by demonstrating that the observer and the observed are inextricably linked.
You just cannot separate them.
Right. But our sources introduce a modern theoretical physicist and philosopher, Karen Barad, who fundamentally changes how we define objectivity by just kicking the door down entirely. She pushes this concept to its absolute limit.
Yeah, Barad introduces a framework called agential realism. She takes the standard Copenhagen interpretation, which is that classic idea that quantum particles exist as a cloud of probabilities and don't have defined properties until they are measured by an observer, and she completely reimagines the mechanics of that measurement.
She transitions the entire scientific focus from interaction to interaction.
Okay, intraaction. I need to wrap my head around that.
Yeah.
Because interaction implies two separate entities, like two billiard balls just existing on their own, rolling across a table and then bumping into each other.
Right.
But interaction implies something much deeper. I'm picturing like a wave in the ocean. The wave isn't a thing added to the water. It doesn't exist independently of the ocean before it rises. It is just the water's potential in action. Is that the difference?
I love when you bring in these visuals because that's the perfect analogy. In interaction, the observer and the particle do not exist prior to their relationship. They emerge through it. The boundary between them emerges entirely through the relationship itself. So the distinct agencies, the scientist, the measuring tool, the electron, they are not billiard balls meeting in a void.
They are temporary waves materializing out of a unified field of potential.
Exactly.
Now, anyone listening to this deep dive is likely familiar with the famous double slit experiment.
Right, the classic.
You shoot an electron at a wall with two slits. If you don't measure it, it acts like a wave and interferes with itself, creating a pattern on the back wall. But if you put a detector next to the slits to watch which one it goes through, it suddenly acts like a solid particle and only goes through one.
And the standard interpretation of that experiment still suffers from the classical spell.
How so?
Well, we tend to view it as the electron really being a particle, but our clumsy giant measuring device physically bumps it and changes its behavior.
Ah, I see.
But Barad completely rejects that.
She argues the electron has absolutely no inherent nature outside of the specific experimental setup.
Yes. So if we connect this to the bigger picture, when we choose to use a detector, we make what Barad calls an agential cut.
An agential cut.
Right. We aren't simply changing a pre-existing wave into a particle. We are physically reconfiguring the universe to materialize a particle phenomenon.
Because the scientist is not standing outside the universe looking in through a glass window.
No, we are part of the matter making nature happen.
So objectivity in Barad's framework isn't a reflective mirror.
No, not at all.
Because a mirror implies a separate reality out there that we are passively bouncing light off of to see.
Exactly. She says objectivity is a diffractive mapping.
Diffractive mapping.
Yeah, think of diffraction like dropping two stones in a pond and watching the ripples overlap and interfere with each other. We are mapping how our specific tools, choices, and bodies interfere with the world to create a specific entangled result.
That actually maps beautifully to the Buddhist concept of the chariot from our sources.
Oh, the King Milinda text.
Yes. There's this famous Buddhist text called The Questions of King Milinda. A sage asks the king to define his chariot. And if you take the chariot apart, where is the underlying chariotness?
Right, where is it?
It isn't in the wooden wheels. It isn't in the metal axle. It isn't in the seat. The chariot has absolutely no inherent identity outside of its specific arrangement of parts and a human being's decision to use that arrangement for transport.
The chariot is a phenomenon that only exists through interaction. Outside of that specific functional arrangement, it is completely empty of inherent identity.
Just like Barad's electron.
Exactly like the electron.
But, you know, I am struggling with a major consequence of this framework.
Okay, what is it?
Well, if there are no solid objects, and if there is no ultimate observer sitting behind my eyes, and everything in the universe is just this interacting web, how can everyday life feel so incredibly vivid?
Wow.
Like, if I take the underlying canvas away from a painting, the painting ceases to exist. If reality has no underlying substance, shouldn't everything feel blurry or ghostly or faint?
That's such a common reaction to this. But the grammar of non-substantialism introduces a concept called functional luminosity to address exactly this.
Functional luminosity.
Yeah. We assume that for something to be vivid, it must be solid. We think the canvas provides the reality. But it is the exact opposite. The display of reality is incredibly vivid precisely because it lacks underlying substance.
Okay, I need you to walk me through the mechanics of that. How does the absence of substance create vividness?
Think of it as frictionlessness.
Frictionlessness.
Right. If there were a rigid mass, a hidden essence, or a foundational core behind every single event, that substance would slow things down.
Always.
It would limit the potential of what could happen because everything would have to drag this heavy hidden anchor around. But because there is no it providing resistance, the potentiality of the universe can manifest with infinite brightness, speed, and complexity.
So what does this all mean? The sources bring up this sensory example, hearing the sharp wunting of a meditation bell. That sound is piercingly real. It grabs your attention immediately. But under this framework, the ing of that bell isn't located in the metal of the bell. It isn't in the wooden stick striking it. It isn't in the air vibrating. And it isn't localized inside your ear or your brain.
No, none of those individual components contain the sound. The ting is a purely relational occurrence. The sources refer to it as a luminous nothing.
A luminous nothing.
Yeah. It is a high-resolution, perfectly functioning transparency that never actually solidifies into a standalone thing. It is a vivid appearance that is simultaneously a sensing of limitless potential.
So if everything is limitless potential and frictionless interaction, we have to explain human suffering.
We do.
Why do I get stressed out by traffic or my mortgage or an argument with a friend? The sources point to the hypnosis of karma.
Mm-hmm.
And to be incredibly clear, we are not talking about karma in the pop culture sense here.
No, definitely not.
This isn't a cosmic tally of good and bad deeds where the universe magically punishes you for cutting someone off in traffic.
No. In this framework, karma is defined strictly as the momentum of habituated boundary setting.
Right, because we exist in this ocean of open, infinite relations, which is fundamentally dizzying to the human mind.
It's overwhelming.
So to navigate it, we mentally freeze boundaries. We draw a line in the water and say, you know, this side of the line is me, and that side of the line is the traffic I am stuck in. Or this is my atom, and that is your atom.
And karma is the repetitive, habituated act of mistaking that non-arisen boundary for a concrete, localized reality.
Mm.
We draw a line in the ocean, and then we spend our entire lives desperately defending the line as if it were a solid ice wall.
Wow. We take an ocean of verbs, we invent a noun to describe a temporary functional pattern, and then we become hypnotized into believing the noun is real.
We trap ourselves in the grammar of nouns.
We really do. And this completely reframes the concept of dependent arising. You know, dependent arising is the philosophical idea that all things only exist in reliance on other things. Like the seed relies on the soil relies on the rain.
Yes. And understanding dependent arising means realizing that spiritual practice or mindfulness isn't about acquiring a new elevated state of mind.
Right.
You aren't trying to build a better, more solid version of yourself.
You are just relinquishing a misconception.
Exactly.
You acknowledge the appearance and the function of the world without imputing a heavy hidden substance to it. You don't try to stop the flow of traffic or the flow of your thoughts. You just stop pretending there is a solid wall separating you from the experience.
You see the appearing as non-arisen. You see the ocean instead of the ice wall.
You recognize the patterns without getting hypnotized by them.
Perfectly said.
I want to bring these massive cosmic concepts directly into the physical space you are occupying right now as you listen to this.
Good idea.
Think about getting up and walking through the room you are in. When you do that, you aren't actually walking through a space filled with atomic things. You aren't navigating around solid, independently existing obstacles.
No.
According to the most cutting-edge quantum physics and the most ancient philosophical traditions on Earth, you are a moving set of interactions within a field of infinite potential. The world around you is a seamless display of dependent arising.
The patterns are absolutely real as patterns. I mean, the table functions perfectly as a table when you set your coffee cup on it.
Right.
But they are entirely empty of a core.
And this raises an important question based on everything we have unpacked today.
It really does. We've dismantled the table. We've dismantled the atom. We've replaced the nouns with verbs. If the entire physical world around you is just a web of relational properties without any solid hidden essence, what does that make the you who is listening to this deep dive right now?
If you try to locate the observer inside your head, the one listening to these words, the one who woke up today feeling so definitively solid, will you find a core entity? Or if you finally break the classical spell, will you find that you too are just another luminous, unfindable pattern in the great dance of interdependence? I highly encourage you to explore that boundary-dissolving thought on your own the next time you knock on a wooden desk.